This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Myasel Spotted Elk. Today on the program, we're airing a recent lecture by Dr. Gunsley Barrick. She is an associate professor in economics at the University of Utah. She spoke recently about the gender wage gap. Specifically, she seeks to debunk some of the myths and misconceptions behind the discussion of why women on average make less money than men. She also speaks about proposed approaches to closing the gap. Currently in the U.S., men generally make 22% more than women, Barrick says. In Utah, the gap is 30%. What's more, the group Voices for Utah Children reported recently that women in Utah earn 70 cents for every dollar that men earn. And they say Utah has the fourth largest gender wage gap in the nation. To reduce the gap in the workplace, Professor Barrick recommends more transparency about salaries and phasing out gender-neutral pay practices, which promotes equal pay without consideration of life choices. Dr. Barrick spoke at the University of Utah on April 9, 2015. Cindy Chen, a senior in political science, will introduce Professor Barrick.
Hello, everyone. Thank you all for being here. It's so great to see so many of you here. First of all, I wanted to thank the Hinckley Institute, Dr. Barrick, as well as you all for being present. And I wanted to briefly introduce the reason why I decided to coordinate this forum today. I've been hearing a lot in the news recently about equal pay, and personally, I don't know what that means in terms of economic statistics, and I've invited our guest speaker here to teach us more about it. Something else that I've found really helpful in my process of learning is an organization that I've been working with called American Association for University Women. And this is a great organization that works to provide resources as well as networking opportunities for women in college. And I have some more information on the counter in the back if you would like to check that out before you leave. And now I will introduce our speaker. So our speaker today is Gunsley Barrick. She is a professor of economics at the University of Utah. She received her BS in economics and statistics at the Middle East Technical Institute in Ankara, Turkey, and master's and PhD in economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She joined the University of Utah faculty in 1994. Her research and teaching areas are development economics, labor economics, and feminist economics. Her research focuses on analysis of gender inequalities in livelihood and well-being outcomes, such as earnings, working conditions, population sex ratios, time use in the household, and training outcomes. The geographic focus of much of this research is on developing countries, but also the U.S. and Utah. She has co-edited three volumes on gender and economic development questions: Inequality, Development, and Growth in 2011, Gender, China, and the WTO in 2009, Social Justice and Gender Equality, Rethinking Development Strategies and Macroeconomic Policies in 2008. She has a forthcoming book, Gender Development Globalization, co-authored with Lourdes Beneria and Maria Floro. More recently, she has been working on broader metrics of economic welfare that includes measures of sustainability. She produced, with Erica Gaddis, the first genuine progress indicator estimates for Utah. And this is our speaker, Dr. Gunsley Barrick.
Thank you, the Hinckley Institute. Thank you, Cindy, for inviting me for this opportunity to address this important indicator of well-being, both in how women fare relative to men, but also sort of an important social indicator. Of course, this indicator is the gender wage gap is also the indicator that put us on the national map last fall with the with this sort of business media sort of ranking that put out by 24/7 Wall Street, and the shock headline was of course the worst state for women in the country. And one of the indicators they used was the gender wage gap to put Utah in the bottom 10 states in the country. Now, of course, as many of our sort of local commentators also pointed out, Utah did really well on the infant mortality rate indicator compared to other states, and you know, the poverty rates are lower in Utah, so Utah did well. But these other indicators, political representation of women and gender earnings gap, were the ones that clearly dominated their ranking. The fact is, of course, no matter how much we try to sort of deny this, the gender wage gap is real, and Utah does not do well on that indicator. Now, despite this importance, this indicator has been often misunderstood and at times maligned, such that there are claims that the gap itself is a myth. So I will be addressing these and other claims in my presentation. So I will start with what is being measured by the gender wage gap, and then I'll address how it has changed in the last few decades and what are the sort of patterns by for different race, ethnicity, education, and occupation groups. And then I'll address the sources of the wage gap and whether or not it's sort of the choices of individual choices that we make as women and men that underlies the persistent gender wage gap. And then I'll talk about why this is an important issue and what are the policy implications. First of all, the definitional issues. The gap is also a ratio. So when we talk about women earn 78% of what men earn, which is the figure for 2013 for the US, that essentially indicates a gap of 22%. So the gender wage gap language, actually, we're often sort of using those interchangeably, and it refers to the earnings of women sort of as a share of earnings of men. Now, that ratio for Utah was in 2013 70%, and with a 30% gap, and it ranked us 48th out of 51 entities, that is 50 states plus the Washington, D.C. What the ratio measures, the samples used, and these are often coming from current population survey of the Census Bureau and the American Community Survey are the sort of the main sources of data for the earnings and labor force information. And they sample women and men older, 16 and older. The ratio, the gap, looks at full-time, year-round employed women and men. So that's 35 plus hours per week and at least 50 hours per year. The earnings involved are median earnings, so that's the middle earning level above which 50% of the earnings lie and below which 50% of the earnings in the, you know, earnings distribution lie. And it's annual earnings, and that means it includes self-employed people and part-year full-time employed people. So, you know, the alternative is usual weekly earnings, which comes up with a slightly higher gender earnings ratio or a smaller gap. I think it's 79.5% for 2013, and that comes from the usual weekly earnings data. Now, the claim number one is that wage gap is a myth. And so often people sort of in the media sort of claim, well, we're really comparing apples and oranges here. The comparison is really not for equal work. And so if you were to compare women and men doing the same work, then the wage gap would disappear. and indeed disappears. So there are some studies that look at very small, very sort of specific cohorts of women and groups of women and men, and which shows much smaller gaps. Now, I would say, I would agree, the unequal pay, those who sort of throw around the terminology unequal pay for equal work are actually making misleading statements. That's an inaccurate characterization of what the gender wage gap measures. I think more accurate would be a gender wage gap is essentially measuring unequal pay for a full day's work or for full-time work. But as we'll see shortly, there is a wage gap within detailed occupations as well. And that sort of gets us to, it's sort of the essentially same occupation means essentially roughly detailed occupations means roughly the same job, and there is a gap within occupations as well. So it's a nuanced, issue, but the big sort of 78% figure clearly is not, representing unequal pay for equal work. Claim number two is the wage gap is closing. And this is essentially our picture for the trends from 1955 to 2014 for weekly earnings. So there are two separate data sets reflected here, and these sort of what the trend is. I mean, you basically are seeing from a rise from around 60% to the current 78 or 79%, and that's sort of the trend. Now, sort of a close-up of what underlies this, and looking at the trends, what we see is, and this is the annual earnings ratio, what we see is that the rise in the earnings ratio or closing of the gender wage gap is obviously coming from two sources, what's happening to median earnings of men and what's happening to median earnings of women. And what we see in the top is that the median earnings of men have been relatively flat over the 1980-2013 period. I mean, of course, it sort of fluctuates, but the trend is flat. So the stagnant male earnings is an important contributor, along with the rise in women's median earnings, to the narrowing of the gender earnings gap. In other words, the men are not doing so well, and that's part of the story of the closing of the gender wage gap. And then, of course, there is, why are women's earnings rising? That's another sort of the other component. And that's really sort of picking up rising educational levels of women, more labor market experience. They're making more headway in higher paying occupations that used to be predominantly male occupations. So there is clearly that progress which is being reflected in the median earnings of women, the trend in that. And the other sort of good news is that the millennial women have a lower earnings gap with men. And these are the sort of 16, 34-year-olds in 2013. And they're doing better than average for the U.S. Now, for Utah, millennials, unfortunately, are, relative to other states in the nation, are not doing as well. So their 78.8% earnings ratio ranks them 49th out of 51. Entities in the U.S. If we look at the other sort of the sort of good picture, but good news is also we have to kind of see the stagnant earnings since 1999 not a good sign for the future, and including for the millennial generation, women and men, who are sort of entered a labor market that's really made for stagnant earnings for both of them. And so basically the picture 1999 to 2013, actually we sort of see decline, average growth rate of the real median earnings during that period has actually been a decline of 6% for men in the U.S. and roughly around that for Utah. And women have made more progress in the United States compared to Utah, but still these are sort of not good trends. And based on this sort of the projections, based on the current trends, and this is sort of a headline-grabbing sort of a projection, and we could quibble about, whether this sort of is a useful projection, but it's sort of, I think, is a again an awareness-raising tool that if we were to continue at this pace, at this sort of the pace that the wage gap has been closing, U.S. gap would not close till 2058. Utah's wage gap would not close till 2102, I believe, and Wyoming is the last one, I believe, in terms of these projections, and that's in the year 2159. So this sort of signals that with all of these sort of current underlying factors built in, the trends are sort of rather sluggish. Now, if we look at behind the wage gap, I mean, we can look at it, parse it in various different ways, but just sort of to highlight some of these sort of different patterns for different groups, I'll focus on race and ethnicity, educational attainment, and occupational distributions.
That is Professor of Economics Gunsley Barrick speaking at the University of Utah on April 9th. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm myself, Spotted Elk. If you're just joining us, Professor Gunsley Barrick has been researching and writing about the gender wage gap both in the U.S. generally and in Utah specifically. She seeks to debunk some of the myths and misconceptions behind the discussion of why women on average make less money than men. Here again is Gunsley Barrick.
Now, in terms of race and ethnicity, the sort of main messages are the following. The gender gaps are smaller among racial ethnic minority groups. I mean, most groups. So you have these, higher earnings ratios among Blacks, Hispanics, Native Americans. So among Hispanics, it's 90.7%. Native Americans, 83.3%. But then sort of another way of parsing this sort of racial gender gaps is to compare each group of women in these racial ethnic minorities racial ethnic groups to the earnings of white men. And when we do that, sort of you sort of clearly see Hispanic women earn, typical Hispanic woman earns 53.3% of what white men make. And if on the other extreme is the Asian Pacific Islander women, 88.5% of what white men make. Now, within these groups, there are quite a bit of heterogeneity. Indian women, for example, in the Asian Pacific Islander group have much, much smaller graph. Quite a bit of variation by race, as I said, in terms of earnings, but also by gender, and so the gaps that are smaller on the left-hand side essentially are reflecting the fact that black men or Hispanic men and Native American men actually earn so much lower compared to other racial groups. And also they reflect, all of these sort of lower earnings, of course, reflect lower college education for some of these ethnic groups. So this is sort of a sort of race ethnicity differentiated story of the earnings gap in the U.S. Now, education level, basically, the highlight, the main message that's going to come out from the figures we're going to look at shortly is that obviously completing a bachelor's degree is good for women as well as men, and men actually need less education than women to make the same level of pay. And the second message is that getting a college degree won't close the gender wage gap. It is often claimed that young women are getting, college degrees at a faster rate than men today, so that's a sign that the gap will disappear soon. But in fact, when we look at the figures, the latest figures, the largest gap is actually at the highest educational level. So that obviously is a problematic, sort of troubling, fact. But basically, for the U.S., what we see is that the bars are getting taller as we move from to higher education levels, meaning earnings are higher if you earn more educational qualifications. And you can see that there is at each educational level, there is a gender earnings gap ranging from 69.6% among those who've completed graduate school or professional degree to 80% among those who completed an associate's degree. And the other sort of troubling fact that this graph reveals is that women who have a professional degree or are graduate, have completed graduate school, actually earn less than men who earn a bachelor's degree. And comparing the first two sets of numbers there. And this sort of, basically, this type of comparison that men actually with lower education level compared to women earn more than women at higher education levels is a, sort of a pattern that is more stark in the case of Utah. And so here we basically see the same pattern. Graduate or professional degree holder women make $56,000, made $56,000 a year, full-time, year-round employment. But that was less than what men made with a bachelor's degree, $65,000. And so, and this sort of goes on, of course, women with bachelor's degrees earn less than men with associate's degrees, men with some college education, you can see that obviously if you are concerned about, if women are concerned about their well-being, obviously it really pays to get more education. It just won't help for the gender earnings gap, is what this figure is showing. Occupational patterns. Here, a well-established pattern is that basically female-dominated occupations pay less compared to male-dominated occupations. And this is sort of almost a stylized fact of the workplace landscape. It is a pattern that is sort of changing, but again, very sluggishly. And now, when we look at Utah, what we see is that, again, this is full-time, year-round employed women. The top three employers of women in Utah, in terms of percentage of employment that they provide for women, are these three occupations: office and administrative support, sales occupations, and education and training and library occupations. So these occupations together account for 48% of employed Utah women's occupations. And and you can see that these are occupations where the percentage of women representation in that occupation is very high. 71% for office administrative support, 71% for teachers and librarians, and sort of 45% for sales occupations, which is sort of not yet a sort of female-dominated occupation. But when you look at men on the other side, on the other hand, you see that men are in general more evenly distributed across occupations, and so their concentration in the top three occupation category is much less. So basically on the order of 32% of men are employed in top three occupations for them. And but you sort of see that these male-dominated occupations, at least the top three, pay much higher salaries, median salaries, compared to the female-dominated top three occupations. Well, what about the wage gap? Now, this sort of picture essentially sort of shows, this graph shows that that for each occupation, all those blue dots lie above a sort of a hypothetical line of equality, meaning if occupations were lined up median earnings in occupations were equal for women and men, they would kind of line up along that straight line, but they don't. They line above, and essentially that shows that in each occupation there is an earnings gap. Men earn more than women, and as the income level rises, earnings level rises, actually the gap widens. In other words, more higher paying occupations actually have wider gaps. Now this again is like the education gap. This again is a troubling issue, because you sort of say, okay, go into these high paying professions, but there you're gonna obviously do better in terms of providing for your family and, you know, contributing to well-being of your family, but you will face a wider earnings gap. Now, that gets us, you know, you're sort of wondering the big question, well, you know, why isn't this a sort of a matter of choice? The gap, you know, the claim that the gender wage gap reflects women's and men's life choices, and of course these are the factors that are often sort of brought up. Well, you know, which major you chose, your occupation, whether you took time off for parenting, whether you're willing to work long hours or in, you know, unpleasant work environments. And these are the reasons why men earn more than women, and hence it is by choice. And so the same argument goes, if we looked at women and men with exact same characteristics, we would see no gap. Now, economists and sociologists essentially approach this question in the sort of the following sort of standard statistical manner, statistical practice that they use. And they essentially sort of take into account all these factors that might make for a wage gap difference between women and men. And they sort of call this, they measure, you know, what, you know, part of the wage gap these factors account, you know, college major, occupation, work experience, and so forth. And then they say, well, what percentage of the gap did we explain with this, with all of these sort of measurable factors of that account for, you know, pay differences? And then they say, that, well, the rest of it is unexplained. And many people sort of refer to that unexplained part as discrimination. Okay. Now, and there's a very standard way of defining discrimination, and this is actually what is part of U.S. law in terms of how discrimination is defined legally in the U.S., and that is basically the payment of different wages for equally qualified women and men, or more generally, different treatment, hiring, promotion, et cetera, for equally qualified two groups or women individuals. So then, you know, the test, the statistical test, is essentially following that sort of line of thinking. Yet, as we'll see, not all of the gap can be explained away, and there is this sort of studies show very commonly show a sort of substantial unexplained part to this earnings gap, which suggests there is something either unmeasurable going on, or there is discrimination, or both, of course, are at work. Now, along these lines, we have a sort of a recent study American Association of University Women, and this sort of study essentially looks at college students 1 year after graduation. So they don't have families yet, they don't have work experience yet, they're just really right out of college, they started jobs, and so it's very, 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 you know, the fresh group essentially looking at. And this is Department of Education data, 15,000 or so sample that was part of the sort of statistical analysis. 1 year out of college, 82% earnings ratio, 18% gap. And now then they kind of go and do this sort of the standard statistical analysis. They take into account an unusually large number of factors which are not usually part of the sort of the standard U.S. You know, current population survey type of or BLS type of data. So they take into account a whole range of factors that could explain productivity and therefore wage differences. And so college major and occupation, current occupation. These are the two most substantial contributors to the wage gap. So those are choices, right? So they're most important contributors to the wage gap. But once all of these factors are taken into account, they still find a 7% unexplained. And that is, I mean, that is a sort of still a considerable gap that is unexplained when you've taken into account hours worked, including, you know, things like workplace character, workplace factors. And these are millennial women, so they are the most educated and cohort. So that's troubling. And you can see that the gap is likely to grow over time, too, for this group with differing promotion and pay prospects. Now, there is a debate about this, and About this sort of the statistical methodology. So some folks who are usually those who claim that this is, you know, gender wage gap is really a myth, those folks generally say, well, we really can't measure everything. We can't measure motivation, work effort, willingness to compete, and, you know, a host of other factors. And if we were only able to measure these, there would be nothing unexplained. In other words, the gap would disappear, and we would. So essentially, for them, the 7% that the AAUW study finds as unexplained is really not discrimination. It just overestimates discrimination. Okay. Now, on the other hand, the counter to that is that the statistical methodology does not consider the fact that some of these lower qualifications, the occupation choice, the college major, et cetera, may themselves be the direct result of labor market discrimination. I mean, it may be that they are, well, the college major, this doesn't quite apply to the AAUW study, but other studies, for example, taking into account industry, occupation, union status, and all of those things, and they may themselves be shaping the occupational choices of women and men. And so that's one factor. In other words, we are sort of overlooking some of the discrimination that's already embedded in some of these sort of skill productivity explaining factors. And then the other issue is, of course, you know, why would you go into some women might say, why would I go into an occupation where I'm going to be, you know, facing hostility or, you know, sort of boys club type of culture? And so women might sort of say, I just don't want to deal with that, and to choose their occupation or college major accordingly. And that, you know, I'm essentially referring to sort of some male-dominated occupations where there is a sort of a boys club culture. And, I mean, I have sort of in mind the recent sort of Silicon Valley case here, where there was a sort of a discrimination lawsuit where the plaintiff lost the case, but it sort of revealed all of the culture that was involved, in, you know, sort of the rituals and that, you know, frat boy. What is it? I have my economist in front of me from last week commenting on this. The frat boy club of money men and the geek club of computer programming's rolled into one, sort of that, you know. So I mean, so it may take some, you know, heart to go into some of these occupations, is all I'm saying. Anyway, for those people who sort of look at this statistical methodology as a sort of a suspicion because it underestimates discrimination. It's already factored into these sort of factors that we thought are explaining the wage gap.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Myself Spotted Elk. Today, Professor Gunsley Barrick is discussing the gender wage gap in the workplace. In other words, why women in Utah tend to earn 70% on average of what men earn. As part of her talk, Barrick also proposes recommendations on how to curb the gap.
Now, why is pay equity important? Wage gap, I'd say, of course, is a family issue. It's also a national and state well-being issue. But obviously, we all are dependent on, you know, our wage incomes. And, I mean, we may have support, some temporary support from the state or from our communities in hard times and so forth. But income is really our sort of main source of livelihoods. And wage is obviously a central source of income for most of us. And increasingly, families are relying on women's wages to make ends meet. And, you know, there's sort of a statistic from a recent study. There is a rise in mothers who brought home at least a quarter of family earnings, 28% in 1967 to 63% in 2012. Now, so obviously, men, as well as women, have a stake in women's earnings being fairly paid and sort of at a decent level. And then there are sole breadwinner moms, and these are, of course, in single-parent households, and they are, of course, dependent on their own earnings. And so, and obviously, you know, we don't get discounts for on the rent or price of groceries just because, you know, women are paying for them. But there is, of course, one sort of ingenious example from a local high school where they actually had this Jordan High School. This was in March. So they had this bake sale where women had to pay, young women had to pay 77 cents for the chocolate chip cookies they were buying, whereas men would pay a dollar. And I mean, obviously, a nice sort of awareness raising sort of bake sale here, but that's not how it works out there in the real world, right? So, but it's sort of, you know, because it does not work that way, we actually then see that women are more likely to be poor because of the pay gap and have fewer opportunities for themselves and children. And this is, of course, more pressing for those single mothers who, are sole breadwinners of their families. And this is sort of from the latest report. Actually, it was yesterday released by Institute for Women's Policy Research. And so I put this together to kind of highlight how Utah poverty rates by household type sort of compares to the U.S. And essentially, I mean, if we focus on female-headed families with children, nationally, 43% of these families are poor. And in Utah, 41.5% of them are poor. And I mean, similarly, male-headed, you know, single-parent families are also poorer, but not as poor. I mean, they're half as poor as female-headed families. So you can see that, you know, this is closing the wage gap will be an important issue in terms of well-being of single-parent families in particular. Why is pay equity important? Continued. I mean, I didn't get into, and I probably won't be able to get into, the issue of part-time work, because 40% of Utah women actually work part-time, and we are, and I'm focusing my attention on the 78% figure, which is, of course, for full-time year-round workers. But we really have to, if we're going to kind of broaden our view of, you know, how do people make a living, then we really have to take into account that some are making a living based on part-time work. And so obviously that's sort of an important component of what needs to be done as well. Now, I also sort of said it's also a national state prosperity issue. If women thrive, Utah thrives. Right? And that's sort of, I guess, nice sort of headline, essentially would refer to more local buying power, helps the economy clearly. Children clearly do better if they are in households where there's a decent income level coming in, and they are the future. So therefore, it's sort of important to pay attention to the pay equity goal. Now, I have a couple of more slides, so I'm almost there. How to close the gap? Essentially, obviously, this depends on the diagnosis of the problem. But what I highlighted, education is clearly one important ingredient in how to close the earnings gap. And clearly, women need more of it. And they also need to kind of venture into some non-traditional fields that are higher paying fields. Now, this of course will help them keep out of poverty and make decent living, but it is not enough to address the pay inequality issue. Employers are also another ingredient besides our sort of individual or collective choices for young women, but employers are sort of the second ingredient. We have several sort of laws that try to address discrimination in pay, promotion, etc. And those clearly have been helpful to kind of raise women's median earnings over the last couple of decades. But they're not enough, and some of the issues that are on the agenda, in national agenda, is to, for example, get rid of secrecy in pay. If you cannot share your, if you cannot share what you're making with your coworkers, then obviously there's no way you can find out if you're discriminated against, along with this equally, skilled kind of coworker. Likewise, so just getting rid of retaliation against workers who share their wage salary information with their coworkers, instituting transparency in pay so that you know if you have these qualifications in these grades of jobs, then you are entitled to such a pay. I mean, so the transparency is a way to actually get rid of some of the sort of lingering differentials. Then there are pay equity job evaluation studies that employers could do to see if women in to see if female-dominated occupations that require the same level of skills and responsibility are underpaid in there compared to male-dominated occupations. These are mostly done by some of the states in the U.S., so in their public sector type of practices, but could be done in corporate and larger workplaces, private workplaces as well. And family work balance clearly is another sort of goal to try and achieve. How about some movement towards paid family and medical leave to ensure families are able to combine work and paid work and family care, paid 6 days. Several states are now instituting some state-level paid 6 days to allow mothers in particular to take time off and sometimes to care for their not just for themselves, but also for their families. And then there's some universal policies we could think about to address low pay in general, which would affect men as well as women, and that would be raising the minimum wage and moving towards a tipped minimum wage, which is the same minimum wage the regular minimum wage. So, and then finally, I would say, if you care about this issue, obviously be alert, participate in the political process, and make your voice heard. So, thank you.
Thank you to Professor Gunsley Barrick, Professor of Economics at the University of Utah. Her talk ran a bit longer than we're able to broadcast today. You can hear the full discussion on KCPW's website. Our program today was made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute Wayne Owens Fund. I'm ISL Spotted Elk. Thanks for listening.